Hey, this is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David, which in one form or another comes to you several days a week at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern on whatever platform you're watching on, which it could include or could be on the Facebook page of Popular Resistance or the Facebook page of KBOO Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon, or on any number of other random places on YouTube, Twitter, VK, LinkedIn, Twitch, or elsewhere on Facebook. And it all goes out as a podcast afterwards if you look for This Week with David Rovics wherever you get your podcasts. And today I'm very happy to be spending the hour with Bill Derisiewicz, who is the author of many books, including the newly published The Death of the Artist, which is really one of the best books I've ever read. And
well,
Bill, I mean, it's just so cathartic. I mean, I've been spending like most of my adult life, making a living of some kind or another as an artist, and like everything, it's just a constant catharsis reading that book. And for anybody else who's ever attempted to make a living as an artist or actually successfully made a living as an artist, it is just, I can't recommend it enough. But at the same time, like most of the young people that I meet who are artists, it hasn't occurred to them to think about making a living. Like, I mean, it's already like the artist is, from a professional standpoint, the artist was dead before they started thinking about making, it's just not even on the radar. You know, of course they're going to have to work a day job and do their art on the side. It's not even, it's becoming something that they're not even, that's not even kind of on the radar anymore. But I was wondering if, first of all, I never know where to start these interviews because there's always too many possible places. But the Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, is another is a book that many of our viewers now have read. And it's also a book that your book was constantly reminding me of, because it's a case study of disaster capitalism as it applies to the arts. I mean, the way that all the big tech companies have just systematically come in to take advantage of the situation, the sort of created by the internet, that and then kind of gone in for the kill on every kind of form of the arts that used to be a profession. I mean, I was familiar with it from a musical standpoint, but you laid it out there in every other form of, I didn't realize that Amazon was doing exactly the same thing as Spotify, as exactly the same thing that Uber has done to the taxi business. Have you read The Shock Doctrine? I don't want to put you on the spot.
I haven't read it, but I, uh-huh. I've read.
Oh, you're familiar with the concept, of it.
I'm definitely familiar with it. Let me say a couple things. First of all, what you said about young artists. I mean, my book is mainly based on a lot of interviews, well over 100 interviews, mostly with artists, also with other people who are work in the arts economy, like editors and producers. Most of the artists I interviewed are young. They were under 40, between 25 and 40 when I talked to them 2 or 3 years ago. So I don't agree that young artists don't even think about earning a living at all. But it's also important to say that earning a living as an artist doesn't necessarily mean that you earn all of your living as an artist, right? I mean, we talk about day jobs, and of course, many artists continue to have to work outside of the arts, work day jobs throughout their entire careers, certainly when they're young. Certainly some of the people I interviewed do that too, but it is important, even if only part of your income is from making your art. Like that in and of itself is really important. So even if the idea of being completely self-sustaining as an artist seems remote, whether you can make some or not, I mean, can often be the difference between whether you can do it at all. Because there's the difference between, say, working a part-time job and working a full-time job. Or, I mean, if you're a musician and you need to tour, then you can't really work a full-time job anyway. So your ability to make some of your money as a musician is really important. About the shock doctrine, I think that's an interesting analogy, but it's really important to say that it's actually even worse. Mm. Because she talks about disasters, often natural disasters that happen, and then capitalism, turbocharged neoliberal capitalism comes in and sort of wipes this, you know, the slate has been wiped clean, and they sort of build back again in their own image, like in New Orleans, say, after Katrina.
Or unnatural decisions, like disasters, like the war in Iraq is another example that she uses, which okay, of course, fair is a enough. Very, very man-made fair disaster.
But the yeah. difference in mm-hmm. tech is that the earthquake or the war is being started by the tech companies themselves. The tech companies mm-hmm. have not taken advantage of a situation. They've created the situation. They are the ones who've built the platforms that have demonetized art.
But wouldn't you say, I mean, they took advantage of a situation that was sort of, to some extent, pre-existing with the rise of the internet and the ability for people to share perfect files like books and MP3s and everything. I mean, this existed before the tech companies then took advantage of that situation and turned it into a sort of a total dystopia. But you wouldn't put it that way?
Well, it's a little more complicated than I made it out. But I mean, you know, I don't know if file sharing was invented by Napster.
Right. No, it predated Napster, right?
Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. Napster took advantage of it. But I mean, maybe this is a point that's not worth debating. The platforms have certainly built out extensions onto, you're right, the internet pre-existed them. But the very forms the platforms take themselves are new technologies that are furthering this or that build on top of the internet to enable them to steal the money that should be going to artists, because that's really yeah. what it amounts to.
And the process, which is so well described in your book, in each of the industries, how they take how they provide initially a service that is actually good and useful, and then because they can change the rules whenever they want to, it seems, then they change the rules down the line. Like when at first iTunes was offering this, people could download music and they paid 99 cents, the artist would get 70 cents of that. The arrangement was something that a lot of artists could live with, especially after they were already used to being, you know, giving away all their music or having it all pirated, depending. But so then at that point, iTunes could come in and say, hey, you can make a little bit of money from this. And then a few years later, then suddenly the rules change, and now we're all giving it away on iTunes, and they're selling it, they're streaming it, and the same model has been duplicated in all these different industries. And it seems so like such a conscious plan on the part of industry, obviously, and exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, bands used to have their own websites. I mean, they still do, but bands used to
have. Nobody goes to them, right? Yeah.
Because they go to Facebook.
Right.
And Facebook's like, hey, come here, everyone come here. Bands basically had to set up their own pages. And that was bad enough because basically you were inviting your fans to be surveilled by a large corporation. But then a few years ago, Facebook started to charge people for access to their own audience. Yeah. That's a perfect example of what you're talking about.
Perfect. Yeah. I mean, it's such a perfect example, because the other examples are a little more subtle, right? Right. I mean, Facebook actually then starting this thing where they're charging people to look at, to access their own audience. Whereas with other examples, like say what Spotify has just done a few weeks ago, which is getting in the news a lot. They have a new thing called discovery mode. Have you heard about this, Bill? This is their new discovery mode. Artists who are on Spotify can sign up to get more promotion by Spotify on Spotify's playlists in exchange for even lower royalties.
That's a perfect example.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. I mean, these corporations are, well, they're evil. I
they really are.
And I'm sure you also know that a few months ago, the CEO of Spotify said musicians should stop complaining about streaming rates and just make more music.
Right. Which I heard that, but the very basis for how Spotify distributes its royalties is, what he's saying is, you know, I mean,
meaningless.
Yes,
because it's a fixed pool, a fixed pot of money based on how much revenue they're generating. So it's not like Spotify is going to pay you more for twice as much of your music. You're just going to cannibalize your own profits, your own revenue.
That's exactly right. But if more people produce more of it, yeah. It's
the only thing that more music will do means more traffic to Spotify, which means they have more data to monetize, which is which is sort of the core scam of all of these platforms, right? They just want as much traffic as possible because that's the basis of their ad revenue.
Yeah.
And they don't care. I mean, I think we can talk about the old and still sort of still existing culture industry, you know, the labels and publishers, the suits. And all the problems with them, but there are also good things with them. And musicians and writers will tell you that. And it's not even that they did things out of the goodness of their heart, although I do think that some of the people in those industries actually really do care about the art that they're handling.
Absolutely.
But even if they, yeah, I think some of them do, but even insofar as they don't, they have a direct financial incentive to invest in artists, because if they don't invest, they won't have anything to sell. But the platforms don't have to invest.
They can just cannibalize.
Yeah, they're not investing any artists. They make you invest in them, really. That's how Melvin Gibbs, who was one of the founders of what's now called the Artist Rights Alliance, he's kind of a legendary bass player. That's how he puts it, you know. That's how he put it to me. We have to invest in them rather than the other way around.
That's now the format. And it's a complete reversal.
Yeah.
I'm in the one of the strange aspects of the modern world is I can never stop my phone from ringing, even when it's off. It rings in my head anyway. And hopefully you and the listeners did not just hear that.
But we did not.
Okay, good. Oh man, it's I mean I want to talk about a little more about the dystopian nature of this situation, because it is, I mean, because what they're doing, what these tech companies are doing, is profiting off of creation that it would never be able to be created under the circumstances of the sort of economics of art that they've created. Like, I mean, unless you are going to get millions of readers or millions of listeners or millions of viewers, then however you're financing your operation, whether you're doing an album or a film or a book, it's not possibly going to turn a profit under their arrangement in terms of, or it's not going to possibly become something that you might be able to kind of live off of as an artist with the way you might have in the past by recording albums or writing books or perhaps even making films or whatever else. They've made sure that you're going to have to basically finance this whole project in some other way and then get it onto our platform, and then you might get an audience, but you'll never actually make that money back 99.9% of the time. I mean, that's kind of like, that's not how they advertise it, but that's kind of the new way. That's more or less the new platform or the new system that they've created.
Yeah, listen, I don't want to overstate the case. I mean, things are definitely very difficult for artists now. They are definitely harder than they were 20 years ago before the internet came along, but before effectively all the things that we're talking about came along. But it's important to say that it's not completely impossible. I mean, like I said, I talk to artists. All the people I talk to are working artists, many of them full-time. Many of them do support themselves from their art, even if it's at a very low level, even if they're making $25,000 and are on food stamps. And part of the purpose of the book was to show how people are doing it. Not in a Pollyannish way, in the typical way that this story has been written for the last 20 years, which is from the Silicon Valley point of view, like, you can be a viral star, you know, like, yes, and you can win the lottery too.
Yeah.
But people are managing through a great deal of hard work, a lot of luck, because as you say, most of the time it doesn't work. And, you know, by circumventing the platforms and or using the platforms, not necessarily in ways that the platforms care about or were designed to be used, but in other words, they're managing to reach an audience and managing to make some money from that audience. And maybe they're also working for an arts organization or working part-time, and maybe they're making some money from touring. And, you know, in other words, you add up, you stack up a bunch of small checks. That's how somebody put it to me.
That's it, yeah.
You might be making money from 15 different things in a given year. And it's as hard as it sounds, including all the work it takes to kind of beat the bushes to get that work and to maintain that work. And yeah, I mean, the platforms have made it really, really hard, for sure. But I don't want to make it sound like it's completely impossible, because that's
not certainly not right. No, that's not right. No, but although I don't want to be a downer. I mean, I'm of course, people should know that it is possible to survive as an artist, but it's also like, some of the stuff in your book, I mean, and which I also learned from, I was doing some research outside of the book, just for some of the source material, the fact that 4 out of 5 working artists in the United States as of 2014, according to, I think it was, some business publication, which I believe was what you were quoting in your book, 4 out of 5 working artists in the United States at that time, and I think now it's probably worse, are white. And that's and yet white people are only, somewhere around half the population. So and certainly not more than half of the actual artists, but in terms of who's actually surviving as artists. And that has so much to do with so many different factors, like, as you describe, and it's a multitude of factors that ends us up in this situation. But taking myself as an example, like so many others, I do largely make a living from crowdfunded patronage, whereas I used to make a living from selling albums. But it's the fact that I used to be touring and selling albums that gave me all these thousands of contacts from which to crowdfund. And there's no way I could have possibly financed all those tours if I hadn't been selling albums, or if I had been independently wealthy, or living in Europe and getting grants. And that's
right. Yes. I mean, 4 out of 5 working artists are white. Obviously there are a lot of factors there, but the one that I really want to call attention to is the financial factor. And I feel that very often now, when we talk about diversity, whether it's in the arts or elsewhere, and we're quite properly talking about it more than ever, but we tend not to talk about the money part.
Yep.
It's not just a matter of, for example, editors in New York hiring more people of color. Their ability to do that depends on how much they pay them. Because if you come, typically the people who work in publishing in New York, whether it's book publishing or magazine publishing, come from money, because in order to support yourself in New York, on the kinds of salaries those industries pay, you have to have help from your parents.
Yeah.
Since wealth obviously has a very heavy racial skew in this country, and probably in every country. So if we want to increase diversity, we have to pay attention to the economic piece of it.
Yep. That's a fascinating thing, that whole phenomenon of these jobs that pay less than you can actually, than you actually need to survive living in a place like New York, that sort of guarantee that you can't do this job unless you have basically inherited a house, or maybe you live in a rent controlled apartment, or some kind of legacy.
Or your parents pay for your rent.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, right. I think that's typically how it works.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right.
Your doctor, mommy, and lawyer, daddy pay for your rent. And then other thing, I mean, connections are also incredibly important in that industry and in other industries, maybe a little less so in music, but certainly in the art world, the visual, high-end visual art world. And what are those connections based on? They're based on where you grew up. They're based on which college you went to. Typically these are people who went to Ivy League colleges or fancy liberal arts colleges. And those schools have a very heavy class filter. Right. I mean, the vast majority of students at those schools come from money.
Mm-hmm. Because that's how it is. I mean, it's one out of three students at MIT was like the valedictorian of their high school. Right. So it's kind of very, very selected if you get to that point before you get into a school like that. Right. I mean, you've probably gone to private schools and you've.
Yeah, that's what I mean. This is one of the things that my previous book, Excellent Sheep, is about. It's about how, it's about those schools and what it does to the students who get into them, just getting into them, and the kinds of families they have to come from, because it takes tremendous resources just to be able to develop, you know, just to have the kind of resume that gets you into those schools. I think actually MIT is probably much more egalitarian than a lot of those other schools, by the way. I mean, typically at schools like that, there are more students from the top 1% than from the bottom 60%. Think about that.
Yeah. Bill, the book is The Death of the Artist. I mean, it's large. I would say maybe it's just, I guess it's, I'm here in the United States in Portland, and it's so much of it resonated with me as an artist living in the U.S., specifically in a heavily rent-burdened city like Portland. A lot of the, you talk a lot about the housing crisis and what an impact that's had on artists. And you also talk about, I mean, so much of these platforms are global and they're impacting artists around the world. But then you also talk about big differences between funding of the arts in Europe and other countries compared to in the United States. I think it was in Europe, it was like 100 times as much funding. It was something, I can't remember the number, but
as a percentage of GDP, it's 63 times as much.
63 times, yeah. And that is, I mean, to me, just anecdotal here, you know, I had to stop touring in the United States about 5 years ago because it was no longer possible to come back with more money than I left with, the way it is for me in touring in the U.S. So all my touring is in Europe, not because I love Europe more than the U.S. in particular. I like touring in both parts of the world and others as well. But the only place I can tour and actually come home with money for the landlord who wants more and more of it every year is Europe. And so that's 90% of my touring is in Europe before the pandemic. And that's because the arts are treated differently there. The whole system is different. There's a labor union in every town and they all have theaters and they subsidize performances in those theaters on a weekly or monthly basis in every town in Sweden and every town in Denmark, you know. But can you talk about that? I mean, in terms, when we're talking about the situation, there's also, yeah, part of that discussion is how could things be done in a way that actually supports artists in the context maybe of, I mean, maybe not in the ideal scenario, but in the context of basically market economies, which is what Europe is, they still manage to support artists. I think in Sweden, I know if you have a newspaper that has 2,000 or more subscribers, then the Swedish government pays for you to have a full-time staff of 7.
Wow. I know that.
I know, because friends of mine in Denmark were wondering, why is the Swedish left press so well organized and so, like, why are they, you know, they seem to have a lot of good writers, and they just, and then I dropped that bit of information, and the Danish journalists were like, oh, okay, they're getting so much, so well subsidized, you know, we're all volunteer over here.
And I believe in Ireland, the first, I think it's 40 or, it's either 40 or 50,000 euro of income earned from art making activities, including writing and so forth, is tax exempt.
Yeah.
Right. There are all kinds of different structures for supporting, whether it's the ones that we've already mentioned or others. What you said about touring in Europe, other people said to me too. American musicians have said I couldn't stay afloat if it weren't for Europe. And the reason Europe is able to offer this is because so much is publicly subsidized. You know, I've come to think even more than I did when I finished the book. The last chapter of the book, as you know, I talk about sort of different ways that artists are organizing and different larger term solutions that I think we need. And to me, the most important one is dealing with the power of the tech companies. But I think I was a little dismissive of some other options when I wrote the book, including public funding and a consumer movement for art, the way we have a food movement, a consumer movement in food. And since then, just in the last few months, I've realized that was a mistake. I think we need an all of the above approach. It's not one solution. One solution is not going to do it. We definitely need to take on the big tech platforms. And it actually seems like there may be movement in that direction, not because of artists, but for other reasons. I think one of the few hopeful things on the political horizon. But I also think that we should, you know, we can't accept this historically ridiculously low level of public funding. The NEA's budget basically hasn't budged in 40 years, even while inflation has eroded away about 80% of the value of that. So it's effectively 20% of what it was. If you also adjust for population growth, it's like $160 million. I mean, think about that. In a country with a $20 trillion economy, the NEA's budget is about $160 million. But even if you add up all public arts funding in this country at all levels of government, it's still about $1.3 billion, which is like $4 a person.
And I think, as you said in your book, the military has a bigger budget for bands.
It's three times larger than the NEA's budget. That's right. It's $4 a person. You know, the state with by far the best arts funding is Minnesota. They already had really good arts funding, but a few years ago they passed a fractional increase to the sales tax, a fraction of which goes to the arts. So it's a fraction of a fraction of a fraction, but it's assessed on every purchase. Of course, in Oregon, we don't even have a sales tax, which is a big problem. But if just as just a small, you know, it's like a half a cent sales tax going to or less, but it generates a huge amount of money for the arts in a very painless way.
Yeah.
The problem is obviously that it's a cultural problem, culture in the broadest sense. We have a culture in this country that's so inimical to the support of culture in the other sense. It's not surprising that it happened in Minnesota because, as I said, Minnesota already had a real public commitment, public in the broadest sense, not just governmental commitment to the arts. But I think we can't just lie down and accept that this is how it's going to be always. And unfortunately, the left, as far as I can see, I know there are other very pressing issues, to say the least, on the left. But it's not even, I never even see it on the agenda.
No. No, I think, why is that, Bill? I mean, because I think part of that is not just the sort of, part of that to me as a lifelong, swimming in the whatever we call this pond of the left in the United States and in Europe, it's part of the problem, it seems like, is that the tech companies are gaslighting us. Like, there's this... and that's a term I only just recently used, so I learned. So I think I'm using it properly. But I think there are left wing ideals, sort of diversity and inclusion and the idea that culture should be free and you know, sort of minus the subsidy, but the idea that this is for everybody in the commons and the idea of the commons, the idea of common, what do they call it? Creative commons kind of is a term that has come out of this whole left-wing idea of the commons, you know, and then it's all been so warped around. It was easy to warp it around, but it's been so warped around to turn into something that has made some of the biggest corporations in the world, has created them just in the past 20 years. So as you say, some of the biggest, the biggest corporations in the world now are these tech companies. But they've taken advantage of this kind of left-wing ideals in a way. And can you kind of flesh that out a bit?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's a really good point. The thing is that the way that tech companies have framed this conversation, and I do think that in the last few years, there's been some pushback finally to this, but the way that they framed this from the beginning of the internet age is to talk about the consumer, is to talk about the user. I mean, they're always, that's their whole thing, the user, right? And we're all the users and we feel, you know, flattered and enriched by this. From the perspective of the user, it looks like you're just getting free everything, and who could argue with that? And when the workers, the artists, pushed back against this, as they did starting with Napster, the tech industry mobilized this intellectual apparatus that talked about freedom in the sense that you're talking about. Instead of copyright, you know, ooh, intellectual property, evil, right? Copyright, evil. We're going to talk about copyleft, you know, It sounds like the left. It sounds like you're progressive, right? It's the only example I can think of where the word left is being used to deprive workers of the pay that's due to them, of the income that's due to them. But it's this, like you said, it's this very kind of clever gaslighting that has a tremendous amount of money behind it and intellectual fellow travelers, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is funded by tech, the Harvard Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society, which is funded by tech, New America Foundation, right? They had a guy working on antitrust. He's one of the most prominent antitrust critics of the big tech platforms. Well, Google is the biggest funder of that think tank, and they got rid of him. Of course, they deny that this is why they got rid of him, but that's why they got rid of him. Mm. This isn't really left. This is, first of all, really, it's libertarianism pretending to be left.
Right.
And second of all, it's completely in bad faith, because the tech companies are only in favor of, they're only against intellectual property protections when it's other people's intellectual property.
When it comes to patents, right, then they're all for it, right? When
patents
it comes
to and code, their right. intellectual property, right. Exactly right. So we're talking about why is it so hard to talk about public funding? Why is it so hard? I mean, there are historical reasons. We're a country that's always been fairly hostile to culture, that's always been hostile to the public funding of culture. But it's also, I think, because of the way the issue has been framed and the fact that artists have always been reluctant to talk about themselves as workers.
Yep.
And the people who are trying to push back against this, and I talk about some of them in the book, and they're actually even new organizations now this year because of the pandemic, they're trying to get visual artists or musicians or writers to think of themselves, to recognize that they're workers and they have to present themselves as workers so that people understand that this is a labor issue like any other labor issue.
But that's been, and that process of trying to understand ourselves as workers, I think it's been sort of, I mean, those of us who have been sort of working artists like for the past 20 years, it's like living through a massive hurricane all the time in a way. Like you're just trying to survive. You're just trying to figure out how have the rules just changed again. I just figured out what the new rules were and now they've completely changed again. And then nobody tells you when the rules change. It's just you figure it out. Like, oh, wait a sec. I didn't sell any CDs on this tour. What happened? Why did that happen? I see Spotify started their free tier. I wish I had even known that this happened, you know? And then, I mean, these kinds of, so then when you're struggling through it, you just don't know, you know, what's happening. And then it takes a book like yours, I think, to for a lot of us to be able to just sort of digest the past 20 years and just kind of realize like, oh my goodness, that's what's been going on all this time. You know, this has been a predatory feast, and I've been the one. I've been the carcass. You know,
right.
It's like,
right. Yeah. Melvin Gibbs, who I mentioned earlier, the bass player, who was one of the founders of it was called the Content Creators Coalition, and now the Artist Rights Alliance. He said that to me. He said most people, they just put their heads down and start running. Like you said, there's no time to even think about it, and I would say, especially in music, in other industries too, but especially in music, the systems are so complicated. They're deliberately complicated. They're deliberately opaque. So it's hard. But it's also true that a lot of these organizations that are organizing, a big component of what they do is education. The Artist Rights Alliance is an example. There's a nonprofit here in Portland called Cash Music. It's called Cash Music, but it's a nonprofit. It makes free digital tools for artists available to artists so that you can, you know, take your audience off of Facebook and bring them to your own website. But they also do a lot of education because, as you say, and it's an ongoing process. So, I mean, it's really hard. You know, artists as a workforce are extremely dispersed. It's not like you have 10,000 people in an auto plant in Dearborn, Michigan, and they're all in one place, and they all know each other, and it's easy to communicate with them, and it's easy then for them, and they all have the same employer, so they see that they have shared interests. Artists not like that at all, but the work is being done, and it needs to be done, and it needs everyone in the arts needs to kind of tune into this and lend a hand.
Right. And kind of reconceptualize kind of what their baseline is in a way. I mean, it seems like a lot of artists have in all fields probably have been for a very long time kind of like always hoping to win the lottery. Like that's been the main kind of driver. And then kind of if they've been surviving at their art, that's been sort of incidental because what they're really after is fame and fortune. I mean, that's what we're told we're supposed to be after. And that's what a lot of people are chasing. And a lot of people are willing and have been willing for a long time to spend a lot of effort and a lot of money and a lot of all sorts of stuff, steal, lie, all kinds of things to get further along in their profession. I mean, and this is the idea we're told that we're supposed to be like competing and trying to get to the top and get fame and fortune. And rather than the idea of, well, actually, how about just getting by and making enough to pay the rent and eat and do your art. Like that hasn't been really sold to artists by artists or by the industry as sort of a goal, right? The goal is getting fame and fortune. And then if that's the goal, it makes it much easier to sort of remove that whole middle ground of survival. Maybe with Spotify's new discovery mode, you make absolutely no money, no hope of survival in the near term, but you might get playlisted and this might shoot you to the top. And it's a mind frame that needs to shift in terms of understanding that we are actually that the goal here is actually just doing the art and being able to get by at the same time. Yeah.
Yes. I will say, though, that I think that what you just described is typically the attitude of young artists. Mm-hmm. And with really remarkable consistency, the older artists I talk to, and they don't even have to be that old, even if even in their 30s, will say that they've come to define success as just being able to continue to do it, which is kind of a remarkable statement. Like, art is such a difficult field that just being in the field constitutes success. But it is what most artists come to. I'm not going to say fairly quickly, but eventually it's what they come to as they realize what the business is, really is. And it's not just a negative thing. It's not just, listen, I'm never going to be a superstar. It's also this, this is so great. This is so deeply satisfying that all I really want at this point is to be able to continue to do it. And I think that maturity, I mean, it tends to be the older people and the more mature people who have the perspective to recognize why organizing is so necessary and important and why they have to think of their work in the way that you just said is the real way you need to think about it, not the lottery ticket. Mm.
I don't know if you've spent much time in Europe, but I've always been especially one of the exceptions to the general rule of being paid well to perform in Europe is the Netherlands.
Is that right?
I don't know. It's just there, and I think, and I resented this, but I love the Netherlands, so I would just keep on going back anyway. And it's also right near Germany and Belgium, where the gigs pay really well. I've long wanted to understand what this was all about. And it seems interesting that it's in the country in Europe that has probably the longest, at least in Northern Europe, sort of the longest tradition of mercantilism. And they also have, I don't know if it's related, but this idea that everybody's an artist, because I think it's fair to say that a larger percentage of Dutch people think that all people are artists, then you'll find that view very commonly there. And then that what seems to go along with the idea that everybody's an artist is that nobody needs to get paid for their art. But it also seems to be because it's also a society that has a 300-year-long history of a welfare system. and where there's been long the possibility of state support if you're not employed and that sort of thing. So I don't know. I wonder if all these things are somehow related.
I don't know about the Netherlands in particular, except that one of the best books about the economics of art is written by a Dutch artist and economist. It came out like in 2002, so it's really pre-internet, but it's called Why Are Artists Poor?
Great.
It's a great book. It's by a guy named Hans Abing, A-B-B-I-N-G. My impression, the impression I got reading for the book is that there's plenty of public support for the arts. I mean, he's mainly talking about visual art. It may be performance in particular that for some reason isn't subsidized. You know, that there's a lot of public support for the arts in the Netherlands as there is across Western Europe, Northern Europe. But you do point to something that I think is really important. We've been talking about the revenue side of the balance sheet, how the tech companies have drained money away from artists by driving the price of digital content towards zero. What we also need to talk about, and I do talk about in the book, is the expense side of the ledger. Part of the reason things are so hard for artists now is because rent is up over 40% since 2000. That's median rent adjusted for inflation, and it's up more in creative centers. You mentioned Portland, obviously New York, LA, et cetera, Austin, et cetera, everywhere.
Yeah.
Tuition, right? Most artists, I would say most artists go to college, probably. Certainly most of the ones I talk to. I think it's very hard to be a writer if you didn't. Increasingly, more and more artists feel the need to earn an MFA for professional access. I would say music, especially sort of popular music, the kind of music most people play, is an exception in this respect. But if you're a visual artist, if you're a writer, certainly if you aspire to teach at universities need an MFA. We know what's been happening with tuition. Rent also means a double, like often artists pay a double rent, right? You have studio space as well. And healthcare. Not that healthcare was ever cheap in this country, but in other countries, free higher education, free universal healthcare, the rent might still be expensive. Maybe they have programs to help out, maybe they don't. But the point is that side of the balance sheet, this is why it's impossible to be a bohemian now. Mm-hmm. I mean, the old model was you lived cheaply, you worked part-time at maybe a minimum wage job, you didn't make a lot of money, but you didn't have a lot of expenses, and you could make your art, and you could live in an artistic community in a creative center where you were, you know, there was a constant interchange with your peers, and it was incredibly enriching, and all these great scenes developed, you know, downtown New York, whatever it is, San Francisco back in the day. It's not possible anymore because it's not possible to live cheaply anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just interviewing an author, a science fiction author, the other day who in the 80s worked part-time in Manhattan and paid for all his expenses and spent the rest of his time writing. Yeah, it was a very common thing everywhere.
People forget New York was a cheap place to live up until the 80s. It's inconceivable now, but it was.
Yeah, inconceivable. Yeah. How's it been doing a book tour during the pandemic, Bill? You've been doing online speaking, I see on your website, quite a few. Did they transfer your book tour onto online? Did that work fairly seamlessly or not?
It did. I mean, I really missed going out and actually meeting readers and interacting directly and meeting people I interviewed. I was looking forward to doing that. The real problem with publishing a book during the pandemic was not that the book tour had to be online. It's that it was impossible to get attention. It was impossible to get attention. I mean, people were talking about the pandemic, they were talking about the election, and they were talking about racial justice, all really important things to talk about. But if you were trying to talk about something else, it's been impossible. And yeah.
despite the fact that artists are probably one of the most impacted groups during the pandemic, given that most artists, if they had another job, it was in the service sector and they lost that job as well as their art job. But it's, we don't conceptualize artists as a sort of profession, and it's a very small profession anyway. So I mean, it just gets lost in the sea of much bigger stories.
And this has been very frustrating to me. I'm actually writing an article about what's happening to the arts during the pandemic. And it's going to come out in Harper's, hopefully in the March issue, which comes out in February. But I had trouble placing that article.
I'll bet.
I had trouble pitching that article.
This is a total pandemic situation, but I got a leaf blower outside.
Okay, I can't hear it.
It's okay. They took the kids. My wife took the kids.
One of those machines that chews up trees across the street. Somebody's shredding trees, but I guess you can't hear it, so it's not a problem.
No, that's good.
But anyway, so I've been tracking this. As soon as the pandemic hit, I started to track what was going on. I knew this would be a disaster for reasons that were not just the obvious reasons, because I understand how the arts economy works. So I immediately went back to the 140 plus people I interviewed and asked them to tell me what was going on. And I ended up talking to about 24 of them. And more recently for this article, I've been talking to new people. You know, the whole idea was, because you can't get paid for anything that can be digitized, so you have to generate revenue with things that can't be digitized. That means crowdfunding, even though it's on a digital platform, crowdfunding, physical objects, merch is what the musicians call it. We in the publishing industry call it books. but mainly live performance. And even for our authors, I don't perform, but I do give talks. And giving talks has become a really important part of the way I earn a living. And that's been true for a lot of authors. Authors, according to a survey by the Authors Guild, over 60% of authors have experienced a drop in income since the pandemic started. You would think, why authors? Well, musicians, we don't even have to talk about. I mean, it's just been a complete disaster for musicians, for actors, for anybody who works in theater. Hollywood and film production was shut down. It's just beginning to crawl back. The Americans for the Arts, which is this big lobbying advocacy or group in Washington, their study from just a couple of weeks ago says that 63% of artists are now fully unemployed. 63%.
Fully unemployed, yeah.
Yes, and 95% have experienced a drop in income. And you're right, it's not just the, it's also what you said, it's all the day jobs. You know, restaurants, bars, coffee shops, driving for Uber, driving for Lyft. These are the things. Working for arts organizations, that's always been a big part of income for artists. You know, you work for a museum, you work for a gallery, a theater, whatever.
Yeah. Or musicians working in music stores. And yeah.
Yeah.
And the, so yeah, the unemployment money that people have been, you know, I've so many artists, and I think in this state, I lost track of the statistics. The last I heard was a couple months ago, but I think 400,000 unemployed people, roughly, and 100,000 of them are gig workers. And of those, there were tens of thousands who, since applying last April, still haven't gotten any checks. And I just got checks from unemployment after 7 months of waiting, which means, just another little anecdotal thing, which I'm sure is common to a lot of artists, is I'm going to be hiring a band to record an album for the first time since 2012, which was just before Spotify started their free tier. And the reason why I have the budget to do it is because of basically unemployment money, and a combination of that and crowdfunding, because that's why I'm alive to receive the unemployment money at this point. But I think, I wonder how many other people are actually doing artistic projects with the money they're getting from unemployment, not having any idea whether they might be surviving a year later. You know, I mean, the sensible thing would be to save it all, right? But I'm sure that I'm not alone in this.
No, you're not alone, because some of the people I've been interviewing in the last few weeks told me exactly that. Uh-huh. you know, one musician who's in what's been a successful mid-tier band, he's thinking, you know, what's going to be next for me? Hopefully the band will go back to touring, but he's been buying recording equipment because he wants to shift to producing and DJing so that he's less dependent on that model. But the other thing you said also people have been telling me is that it's another example of the fact that our unemployment laws and our unemployment systems, our employment laws rather, and our employment systems are not set up for gig work.
Mm.
So unemployment is designed for people who have regular jobs and get W-2 forms and have an employer. And it can't deal with people who make 1099 income, who work as independent contractors. It has trouble dealing with people whose income is very inconsistent. So this has been a factor with some of the small relief programs that have happened in Austin and other places. Small business, like if you don't have a certain level of income, you can't be a small business. If you have too much income, if you know you had a big licensing deal last year, then it looks like you don't need the money,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you're reporting 2019 income for a lot of these programs, but maybe 2019, you know, was the best year you've had in 10 years.
Yeah.
And as you say, I mean, people have, you know, some people have been waiting months and months and months to get a check.
And when you were talking about doing speaking tours as an author and how many authors have been losing money, and this is something that I think most people who, I think has become common knowledge because you're hearing about it on mainstream news programs about how difficult it is for musicians in the new economy with Spotify and everything. And so the common received wisdom is now musicians survive by touring. As if they didn't do that before, you know, like, you know, but our authors are surviving by touring as well. And it's just, it's less intuitive, but of course this is the same phenomenon.
That's right. And visual artists who, a lot of their money now comes from teaching workshops, teaching classes. People do cruises, whether it's musicians or some, you know, some other kind of, comedians, whatever. That's right. And I mean, this is what I talk about in the book is how have people adjusted over the last 20 years to deal with this new economy? And it's things like that. Yeah. Also branded art, corporate sponsorship, doing gigs for companies.
That's another thing that's so interesting because, like, I mean, I was just interviewing Danbert Nobacon from Chumbawamba, the band Chumbawamba, a few weeks ago, and they had a number one hit in the 90s, Tub
Yeah,
Thumping,
yeah.
You know? And so because of that hit, I mean, it was the economics of what happens when you have a number one hit, but only one, it's fascinating. And, you know, it sort of allowed the band to sort of temporarily enter the ranks of the middle class, you know, and buy houses and that sort of thing. But now what was I going to say about Danbert? Now, see, we got not only do we have the leaf blower outside, but it's a gas powered leaf blower, and there's literally fumes coming in here. And I've been trying to get the landlord to ban the gas powered leaf blower for a month now. But I know what I was thinking. You know, as I how much do you think the idea, if we're thinking about just in the last 7 minutes here, and if we're thinking about the future, the ideal future for how arts could be funded, like, I mean, I have no idea, you know, what the ideal is, because one thing that I have struggled with and sort of noticed over the course of many decades is that suffering actually does, in many cases, produce great art. And, you know, I'm not prescribing suffering for everybody at all, but I just can't help but notice that among the privileged, comfortable artists of Europe, the level of technical proficiency is not as high as among the average American musician, specifically among non-classical musicians, among improvisational musicians. I think the Americans get a lot more practice because they have to, like they do a lot more performing because they have to, and they get better because of that. And I mean, or they just die, you know, have a heart attack on stage.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. Actually, that same guy I was just talking about, that same musician, he's in a funk band called Turquoise. It's a 9-person funk band. He said that because they tour around the world too. And He knows musicians everywhere. And he says that people in Europe and musicians in Europe and elsewhere are just in awe of the infrastructure of live performance that's grown up in this country in the last 20 years because of the need for touring. And he thinks that it's led to a very high level of musicianship. But I do not buy the art thrives in adversity argument. I mean, there is a connection between art. Here's what I would say. There's definitely a connection between art and suffering, but everybody has plenty of suffering in their life. Everybody has plenty of psychological anguish. You know, your daddy was mean to you. Your partner broke up with you. You have a chronic illness. There's plenty of suffering. I don't think that poverty enhances artistic production. I do not believe that. Yeah. As to what we can do, I mean, like I said, I think it's an all of the above. I do think that we didn't really talk about this, but a consumer movement for art where we raise the consciousness of consumers and say, listen, there are other people, there are people at the other end of the supply chain, and you need to actually pay for this stuff because you need to realize that if you're getting something valuable for free, there must be a problem because that's not how it's supposed to work.
But is it for free? I mean, because the companies are making a lot of money, so they're collecting the data.
But it's free to the consumer. Free to the consumer. And that's why people have been perfectly happy to go along with this in complete ignorance of the reality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, people are now getting hip to the fact that the companies are surveilling them, but it's still not stopping them. And it's not quite stopping them behaving that way. And it's quite frankly, it's not going to stop. People are not going to get off the platforms. But maybe with some concerted education, I also think the big stars need to speak out about this. Not people like me and you, but like the big music stars and other art stars that people that really listen to and say, guys, everyone is suffering and the arts can't survive like this because you can't just have superstars come from somewhere. We all came from somewhere. You know, the local club, the Stone Pony in Asbury Park, whatever it is. But also the solutions, I say this in the book, the solutions to the arts economy, many of them don't lie in the arts. They lie in creating a more just society. And doing things like dealing with the cost of education, the cost of housing, the cost of healthcare. If we just did that, even without touching Spotify, although we should touch them pretty hard, if we just did that, this would be much more doable for people. And therefore, the arts would be much more diverse and more equitable.
It's hard to imagine even actually what the state of affairs would be with the arts in this country if not for the housing crisis. I mean, if rents in New York were what they were in the 80s, I don't know if we'd really be having any kind of a serious problem.
Well, it'd be a problem, but it would be a much, much smaller problem. I mean, rent is the biggest problem. It's the biggest financial problem in the lives of artists. I think that that's certainly what my research suggested to me.
Yeah. Another cathartic bit of the reading was how often you refer to that.
I have a whole separate chapter on it because it's that important.
Yeah. Yeah. Bill Derisiewicz, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. And thank you so much for making the time.
My pleasure. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Take care. Hope to see you around. And thanks, everybody, for listening in to this discussion with Bill Derisiewicz, author of the recent new, freshly on, hot off the shelves book, The Death of the Artist, a cathartic bit of reading for anybody who has made a living or attempted to make a living or has any interest in the arts or knows anybody who's ever attempted to make a living at the arts. You should read this book, The Death of the Artist. Fantastic, fantastic stuff. And I will be back for more interviewing more folks on Friday. Actually, I'll be interviewing a longtime studio owner, producer, engineer from Big Red Studio in Corbett, Oregon, Billy Oskay. And then on Saturday, I'll be doing a concert right here on the internet from my living room at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. All right. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Remember, mutual aid will get us through. Don't pay the rent. Trust your neighbors. Bye for now.